presents the Sophia Teachings, Session 2 with Robert Powell.
The Trojan War was a very significant moment in human evolution. What actually took place at this event? Well, let's first consider something of the background to the Trojan War. King Priam was king of Troy and had many sons. Now, how did the city of Troy come to be built? This is a fascinating legend in which we hear that Ilias, who was the founder of the city of Troy, one day was asleep and had an extraordinary dream that the gods were communicating with him. And when he woke up, he found a statue of Pallas Athena. Pallas Athena is a woman holding a shield and carrying a spear. And according to mythology, Pallas was the companion of Athena, killed in battle. And Pallas Athena represented the goddess Athena in her fighting aspect. Athena, in terms of Greek mythology, was born from the head of Zeus and was a goddess of wisdom. At the founding of Troy, this was through the blessing of divine wisdom, because Ilion built the city of Troy to house the sacred object, Pallas Athena, this statue which is called the Palladium. And it was said that whoever possessed the Palladium would have rulership of the world. So Troy possessed the Palladium. The Palladium was housed in a special underground temple and was guarded over by Vestal virgins. There was a sacred fire burning in this underground temple 24 hours a day and night, and this was the source and the seat of the extraordinary power of the city of Troy. So what does this mean? It tells us that Troy was the last citadel of the ancient Oriental wisdom. It was here that the wisdom of the Orient reached its final crystallized form, Troy being located in Asia Minor. And yet, Troy as the seat of wisdom was not to remain invulnerable. This is what the Trojan War is all about. So, how did the Trojan War begin? We come now to King Priam, who was king of Troy, probably around 1200 BC. We don't know the exact dates. He had 50 sons. One of them was Paris. Now, during the pregnancy, prior to the birth of Paris, his mother had a dream that with him, the city of Troy would become destroyed. So in order to avoid the fulfillment of this dream, Paris was sent as a small baby to grow up with shepherds on Mount Ida, some distance away from the city of Troy. Paris grew up there, knowing nothing of his status as prince of Troy, and was a very beautiful young man, a shepherd. Now, a quarrel broke out between the three goddesses, Hera, the wife of Zeus, the goddess of power, and Athena, the goddess of wisdom, and Aphrodite, the goddess of beauty. The quarrel between them was who was the greatest. They decided that a mortal should decide which of them was the greatest goddess. So they chose Paris to solve this question. The three goddesses appeared to Paris on Mount Ida, presented him with a golden apple, and said that he should give the golden apple to the goddess who he thought was the greatest. So Hera promised him conquest of many lands, of undreamt of power. Athena promised him all the wisdom that she could bestow on him. And Aphrodite's promise was that she would find him the most beautiful woman in the world. Paris chose Aphrodite and handed her the golden apple, and Aphrodite had to fulfill her promise. So she visited Helen, this Greek wife of King Menelaus, and caused Helen to fall in love with Paris. So Paris was guided by Aphrodite to visit the home of Menelaus and Helen. And during this time, Menelaus was briefly absent, and Paris abducted Helen, sailed off with her to the city of Troy. So Helen became Helen of Troy, the most beautiful woman in the world. All of this points to a Sophianic theme that actually the gift of Aphrodite, which is the gift of love, will one day ascend over the gift of power, that is the gift of Hera, and the gift of wisdom, which is the gift of Athena. It's a prophetic story. Following the story further, the Greek kings were, of course, outraged at this event and decided to take revenge, to sail to Troy and to capture back Helen. So they set out on a great voyage, raised a large army, came to besiege the city of Troy, and took with them their finest heroes, amongst them Achilles and Odysseus. Achilles, who represents brute strength, and Odysseus, who represents cunning, wisdom, intelligence. As we know from Homer's description of the Trojan War, this war continued for 10 years, and it seemed that the Greeks simply could not capture the city of Troy, owing to the fact that Troy possessed the Palladium. Now, according to one version of the story of the Trojan War, Odysseus, disguised as a beggar, came into the city and was able to capture and remove the Palladium from the city. This was the first stage of the conquest of the city. The next stage was that Odysseus thought of the construction of the Trojan horse, this huge wooden horse in which were hidden several Greek soldiers. A message was left attached to the Trojan horse saying, "Herewith the Greeks acknowledge the superiority of the Trojans and bestow this horse as a present and return to their country." So the Greeks left the Trojan horse on the beach, and they themselves got into their ships and set sail, but withdrew only for a short distance. When the Trojans came out of the city and they saw this extraordinary present, the Trojan horse, they wanted, of course, to bring the horse back into the city. Despite warnings that this could be a trick on the part of the Greeks, the Trojans actually took the horse back into the city. That night, the Greek soldiers who were hidden in the belly of the horse came out from the horse and began to slay the Trojans and open the city gates, so that the Greeks, who had in the meantime returned in their ships, were able to enter and conquer the city, and in this way to regain Helen of Troy. So in this story, we find that the divine wisdom became allied with the Greeks, especially in the figure of Odysseus, who represented this new faculty of intelligence. And here we see a symbolic transition from ancient Asian culture to this new and young culture of the Greeks, that the Greeks were to become the ascendant people, were to become the vessels for the next stage of evolution, supported and guided by the divine wisdom. So this story really points to this extraordinary moment of transition in history from Asia to Greek and European civilization. So now we can think of Sophia actually as the mother of Greek and European civilization. We find the arising of Greek culture, the founding of the Greek city-states, under the inspiration of Athena, the goddess associated with the Palladium. And Athena we can look upon as the inspirer of the Greek philosophers. We find the seven sages of ancient Greece arising in Asia Minor, but really being the bearers of this new culture, this culture which meant the active engagement of human intelligence, human thought. So in order to characterize this transition still further, we could say that ancient Oriental civilization, up to and including the Trojan civilization, was based not on the power of thought, but on what we could call ancient clairvoyance, a power of vision. And this is the transition from Oriental culture to Greek culture, signified by the transition from clairvoyance to thinking. Now, why did this transition need to take place? Well, this has to do with the evolution of the human being to become an independent being. And this is really bound up with our ability to think. Through our ability to think, we are free and independent human beings. The ancient clairvoyance was a kind of dreamlike faculty, an ability to see and perceive spiritual events, spiritual beings, to behold the creative powers of existence, pictured as the different gods and goddesses. But this meant that man, woman, were still subservient to the gods and goddesses, were not able to be free and independent beings in relationship to the gods and goddesses. Whereas through the development of thinking, this ability to be free really began to come about. And to illustrate this more clearly, I'd like to refer to another Greek myth, which brings this out in a wonderful way, and that is the myth of Perseus slaying the Medusa. According to this Greek legend, Medusa was a beautiful woman at one time, but during the course of time, she developed for her hair snakes. Snakes coming out of her head. And it is said, according to this legend, that anybody who would look at the Medusa would become turned to stone. So what does the Medusa really symbolize? The Medusa in this legend is a depiction of the ancient power of clairvoyance, what in the East is called the power of the serpent or the Kundalini power. So the snakes coming out of the head of the Medusa show this ancient force of clairvoyance really gone wild and having become a danger. so that any human being exposed to this force could become paralyzed in their own being. It could become unfree through not having a free relationship to the visions arising through their clairvoyance. In order to understand this, if we imagine what it's like when we're dreaming, in a dream condition, we feel powerless. We feel that events take place without our free initiative. In a dream condition, we are not really free to act and think independently. And so this points to something of the quality of this ancient clairvoyant faculty, which was universal. All human beings possess this. Then we see in this legend, Perseus, this young Greek hero who represents the new Greek faculty of intelligence, decides he will slay the Medusa. Now, how is he going to do this? Because the Medusa is such a terrifying appearance, and just one look from her is sufficient to turn one to stone. Perseus was aided in his conquest of the Medusa by Athena, the goddess of wisdom. Here again, we see another indication that Athena, as an aspect of the divine Sophia, was really behind this shift in human evolution to the development of intelligence. So Athena accompanies Perseus to the place where the Medusa was living, and she holds up her shield so that Perseus can look into the shield and see the reflection of the Medusa. And walking back with the shield of Athena, he is able to cut off the Medusa's head. So here we see the application of intelligence to overcome the terrifying power of the ancient clairvoyance. There is still a further aspect to the story of Perseus slaying Medusa, which helps to bring out this transition that took place from ancient Oriental culture to Greek culture, and this is contained in the legend relating to Andromeda. Andromeda was the daughter of King Cepheus and Queen Cassiopeia, king and queen of Ethiopia. They have this beautiful daughter, Andromeda, who in a certain respect represents the soul of the world, just as Helen of Troy represents the soul of the world. Andromeda was very beautiful and was dearly loved by Cepheus and Cassiopeia. However, there is a big problem in the country that a sea monster begins to threaten the country and causing destruction. The king and queen hear from an oracle that the only way to save their country from destruction by this sea monster called Cetus, who is like an enormous whale, is through the sacrifice of their daughter Andromeda. So here we see in this symbolically that the soul of humanity, Andromeda, is being threatened by this atavistic force of the will, which is represented by the sea monster, a force from the depths. Through this atavistic force of the will, the great structures such as the pyramids, Stonehenge in the British Isles, were able to be built in antiquity. This was an enormous strength of will, but just as the ancient clairvoyance was also a threat to the development of the free personality, so too this atavistic force of will was a threat to the development of the free personality. And so Perseus also had the task of saving Andromeda. At the very moment when Andromeda was bound to the rock and was to be devoured by Cetus, Perseus appears holding the head of the Medusa turning the evil eye of Medusa to Cetus, the sea monster became turned to stone. So here we see the use of intelligence to overcome also the atavistic power of the will. All of this under the guidance and inspiration of Athena, the goddess of wisdom, an aspect of the divine Sophia. In the Greek mythology relating to Perseus, we see the representative of the new consciousness, Greek consciousness, consciousness of the free personality, using his intelligence and his power of thought in order to be guided through life. Perseus, of course, is a mythological figure, whereas Odysseus, who in the account of Homer was the key figure in the conquest of the city of Troy through the use of intelligence, was a natural Greek personality. We know that the Trojan War actually took place in that the German archaeologist Heinrich Schliemann was inspired and guided to the actual site where the Trojan War took place and was able to discover the city of Troy. We thus see how Greek civilization began to ascend and how philosophy, the love of Sophia, played an important part in the rise of this civilization. One of the first Greek philosophers was Thales, who was born around 624 BC and who, around the start of the 6th century BC, began this development of Greek philosophy, which then culminated centuries later with Plato and Aristotle. Thales was a thinker who thought deeply about man's relationship to the world and about the origin of the world. This was the central question that occupied the Greek philosophers. What was the origin of the world, and what is the human being's relationship to the world? Thales conceived of the world having coming to being from the substance of water, whereas shortly after, the Greek philosopher Heraclitus of Ephesus conceived of the world having originated through the power of fire, which he identified with the Logos. So we see the Greek philosophers really wrestling with the question of the origin of the world and of the human being's place in the world. This was the birth of philosophy. These were inspired by Sophia, by divine wisdom, that human beings could begin to form a new relationship with Sophia through the use of the power of thought. This is really what gave birth to philosophy. And if we consider the original meaning of the word philosophy, philosophia, love of Sophia, it was really love for the divine wisdom who was present from the beginning of the creation, really as the divine plan of the creation. The philosopher Pythagoras was the first to call himself a philosopher, to actually use the expression philosophy. So I'd like to just focus briefly upon Pythagoras as a central figure in the Western Sophia tradition, a key figure who gathered together the threads of the ancient wisdom, carried them over into Greek culture, and founded a mystery school in southern Italy. Pythagoras was born in the first half of the 6th century BC on the island of Samos and travelled around to gather wisdom from the different traditions of the ancient world. He visited Egypt, spent many years studying under Egyptian priests, and gained entrance to receive the initiation in Egyptian temple. He then later visited Babylon to receive instruction there from Zoroaster, known to the Babylonians as Zarathustra, who was considered to be the wisest human being of that time. We learn that Pythagoras received initiation in Babylon from Zoroaster, who, so it is said, cleansed him of the impurities of his previous life. Through Zoroaster, Pythagoras learnt of the mysteries of the cosmos and returned to Greece to begin to teach these mysteries in a new way, in a way different from the Oriental manner of Zoroaster and the Babylonians, and different from the Egyptian priesthood. So Pythagoras was a human being who received the rich treasures of the ancient mystery wisdom tradition and brought them into Greek consciousness in a form appropriate for the Greeks, a form based on the principle of thinking. The mystery school that Pythagoras founded was at Croton in southern Italy, and we know very little about the content of this mystery school because his followers were sworn to secrecy. But it's clear that there were many cosmic mysteries that were taught in this mystery school in southern Italy. So with Pythagoras, we have an important figure in the Sophia tradition, a bearer of the ageless wisdom, but one who brought this wisdom into a new form, into a form that could be accepted, a form appropriate for the human thinking consciousness. Later Greek philosophers such as Plato considered themselves as continuers of this path of Pythagoras. Plato referred often to the teachings of the Pythagoreans, and Plato's philosophy itself revolved around a central concept, that is, the world of ideas. That the task of the philosopher is to gain access to the world of ideas. This teaching of Plato is actually none other than a pointing to Sophia as the wisdom of the cosmos. We could call Sophia, in the sense of Plato's philosophy, the idea of ideas, the central wisdom from which all ideas have sprung. So Plato was, in his own way, somebody devoted to the divine Sophia. Looking at this transition from what we were looking at before with Sophia as the inspirer of King Solomon to Sophia as the inspirer of Greek philosophy, we see a major transition from a creator being the handmaiden or the co-worker of Yahweh in the Jewish tradition, to the inspirer of wisdom in the Greek tradition. So it's important if we keep this difference of focus in mind and see how this unfolds in the further development that took place after Greek civilization. Coming again to Plato, Plato was a truly great philosopher, one who absorbed into himself the content of the ageless wisdom teachings of Sophia from the ancient mysteries, but who transformed all of this into philosophical form. We could say that Plato's philosophy is really Sophianic mystery wisdom in idea form. Another enormous transition took place if we look at the step from Plato to Aristotle. Aristotle was initially a pupil of Plato, but then developed his own philosophy in the city of Athens, founded his own school. Aristotle was really concerned with not so much the world of ideas, but the actual material world and the world of nature spread out around us. This was a dramatic shift. Aristotle, in a certain respect, was the founding philosopher of the Western scientific tradition. For Aristotle, what was important was the phenomena of nature, the clouds, the rivers, the fields, meteorology, astronomy, biology, ethics. These were the domains with which Aristotle occupied himself. So Aristotle, this extraordinary genius of Western mind, gave the impulse for the turning away from the world of ideas to the natural world. And this too was an important step, one which has led to the extraordinary achievements of Western civilization. This would be unthinkable without having made this step away from this focus upon the world of ideas, such as we find with Plato, to a focus upon the natural world, as we find with Aristotle. Important for our considerations of the Sophia tradition are also the Stoic philosophers. They were the continuers of the philosophy of Heraclitus. So I'd like to go back briefly to Heraclitus, as this also is important for our considerations of the subsequent development of the Sophia tradition. Heraclitus lived in the city of Ephesus. He was an aristocrat, but decided at an early age he was going to dedicate his life to philosophy. Heraclitus came into the precincts of the temple at Ephesus, the great temple of Artemis. He lived there a hermit-like existence and wrote his major work, Periphysion, meaning about physics, or we could say about nature. In this work, he describes the Logos as the creative fire at the origin of all existence. This was, for Heraclitus, a sacred task, the writing of this work, a task which he dedicated to Artemis, to the great goddess of Ephesus. And having completed this work, he brought it into the temple and laid it at the feet of the statue of Artemis in the great temple at Ephesus. We know next to nothing about the content of this work. What we know of from commentators who have written about the content. The Stoic philosophers took up the teaching of Heraclitus and elaborated this teaching of the Logos as the creative fire, the creative power of existence. In consideration of the Sophia tradition, we come to something very important, that is the relationship between the Logos and Sophia. Really, the whole of Western cultural tradition has been shaped by the Logos, first in terms of the Logos philosophy, then in terms of Christianity, considering Christ as the incarnated Logos. The question is, what happened to Sophia? And what is the relationship between the Logos and Sophia? I'd like to use an analogy to characterize this relationship. Logos means word. And so in thinking of the Logos in terms of Heraclitus' philosophy as the creative fire at the beginning of existence, that all creation came into existence through the Logos, this means we can conceive of a divine word which called all of existence into being. In order to form a conception of this, we can think of the extraordinary power of sound. In the 18th century, the physicist Chladni demonstrated how sound vibrations form and shape particles of dust into intricate shapes. So we can conceive of this creative power of the word as a forming, shaping force which was at work in the whole of creation to call forth all that we can see and experience around us of the material world. Preceding this material existence was, therefore, the creative power of the word, which shaped matter into the forms that we know of. So this gives a picture of what Heraclitus is speaking of as a creative fire, the Logos, the word, at the beginning of all creation. So where is Sophia in this picture? Sophia as the divine wisdom. Well, if we think of, by way of analogy, our own power of speech, when we speak, hopefully underlying what is being spoken is intelligence or wisdom, that wisdom is actually closely allied with the word. So in a broader context, we can conceive of Sophia and the Logos working together in the creation, Sophia as the wisdom, the plan for the shaping of the creation, the Logos as the power, the word that shapes the actual creation. So here we have an interweaving, a working together of the word and wisdom, wisdom underlying the word. We can conceive of these as two halves of reality. And if you like, we could call the Logos, the masculine creative power of fire, which shapes existence, and Sophia as the wisdom, the feminine creating, shaping vessel for the creative force of the word. In this way, we can form a picture of the relationship between the Logos and Sophia. Now, this is significant in terms of considering the whole development of philosophy. We can see that in the philosophical tradition coming down through Pythagoras to Plato, the focus is more upon divine wisdom. Pythagoras as a seeker of divine wisdom, of Sophia. Plato as the philosopher of the ancient wisdom, depicting this in terms of the world of ideas, and the central idea being Sophia. This we could call a feminine direction in philosophy. On the other hand, looking at Heraclitus and the Stoics and Aristotle, we see the focus is on the masculine creative power of the word, the Logos, and how this works into the creation. So we could contrast Platonic philosophy and Aristotelian philosophy as Plato's philosophy being more Sophianic and Aristotle's philosophy being more related to the Logos. So I think this is an important distinction because it was actually Aristotelian philosophy which triumphed in the end in the history of Western philosophy. so that we find this thrust, this looking to the logos, becoming the predominant element in Western philosophy, which led then to the whole emergence of Western science and technology. Now I believe a new direction has to come in. We could say that science and technology have reached a point of crisis. There has been a one-sided masculine direction of development, and that there has to be a change. In philosophical terms, we could say there needs to be a reorientation, a turning back to the divine wisdom, Sophia, a turning back to what Plato would call the world of ideas. And I think in the 20th century we can see signs of this. We consider, for example, the psychology of C.G. Jung, which introduces the whole concept of archetypes. We can see that in this psychology of Jung, we have a turning back to the world of ideas. The archetypes of Jung are a new and modern form of expression of what Plato was referring to. So we will look at the whole development that has led to the disappearance of Sophia, really at the time of the founding of Christianity. I shall go into this in more detail, how Sophia really became lost or became concealed. And I would also like to return to a consideration of the story of Perseus and the Medusa in relation to our time. If we look at the whole development of Western thought up to our time, we can see the great achievements of Western philosophy, theology, and science, leading to the whole development in the 20th century of technology. Our world has become completely changed through the application of science, through technology. And yet we can also see an enormous threat and challenge to the whole future of the Earth if this one-sided, logoic, rational mode of relationship to the world were to continue. This whole development really is calling for a new direction, and this new direction, I believe, is to be given by Sophia through the opening up of the qualities of the heart. To look at the culmination of this whole development, we have arrived at the present time with the development of the computer almost at a dead end. The computer signifies the mechanization of human thought. It is no longer the living, creative thinking of a Plato or an Aristotle, but rather the turning of our thought into mechanical thinking, which is the thinking of the computer. I'm not saying anything against the use of computers, which are, of course, extremely helpful for all the mechanical kinds of tasks that we need to accomplish, tasks of calculation, tasks of banking, ordering, and so on. As long as the computer remains our servant, then there is nothing to be said against it. But the danger is that the servant begins to overtake us, begins to occupy our thinking more and more, begins to take over our thought life. And this is an enormous danger, a danger which I think we can see would be like a new kind of Medusa. In other words, if we think of the image of the Medusa, we can see how this image also could apply to the computer screen, the image of the possibility of becoming so to say, turn to stone through sitting for hours on end, motionless in front of this image. The evil eye of the Medusa in the past was able to turn human beings to stone, and in this image of the computer we have a new threat, the possibility of becoming turned to stone. I don't mean in a literal sense, but in a metaphorical sense, in that we give up our own free creative powers of thinking, are turning towards the divine wisdom. Instead, through the computer, we may find we substitute human thoughts for the divine wisdom, and that we lose our very ability to move, which is a God-given creative faculty. So, in terms of applying this Greek myth to our time, that of Perseus and Medusa, what would be the new challenge for Perseus of our time? This would be the challenge, with the help of divine wisdom, to go beyond the level of computer thinking. That just as 3,000 years ago, there was a transition from mythological thinking of the ancient clairvoyants to the thinking of Greek philosophy. So now there needs to take place a transition from computer kind of mechanized thinking to a new kind of clairvoyance, a new seeing, a new thinking that is able to see in pictures. And I believe this is the transition that is to take place now. We could call this a thinking of the heart, a radiant ability of thought through the opening up of the heart under the inspiration of divine Sophia, which will lead us to a new faculty of seeing, an ability to see, but an ability to see which does not dampen down or blot out our thinking ability, but which takes our thinking a stage further, where thinking becomes seeing. I see this is the great transition that humanity is to make into the future. But before going on to consider this new faculty, which will come about through the inspiration of Sophia in our time, I'd like to go back to return to the question of how did it come about that Sophia disappeared from Western culture and civilization? How did it come about that Sophia disappeared as the source of inspiration from Western culture and civilization? This obviously has to do with the relationship between the Logos and Sophia. Key to an understanding of this transition is the Jewish philosopher Philo of Alexandria. Philo was actually a contemporary of Christ. He died in about 45 AD, and he was schooled upon Greek thinking. So he took over the ideas of the Stoics, and through this he had a conception of the Logos as the creative fire, the creative power of existence. Philo gave a picture of creation which included Sophia. He, as a Jew, was, of course, familiar with the wisdom books of the Old Testament, of the books of wisdom attributed to Solomon. And so he had a living picture of Sophia as the wisdom of the creation. And how did he incorporate these two, Sophia from the Hebrew tradition and the Logos from the Greek tradition, into his philosophy? He developed a picture of Yahweh as the creator who produces or creates Sophia as the first created being. And then he conceives of Yahweh through Sophia, or together with Sophia, creating the cosmos, which he identifies as the sun of Yahweh and Sophia. He identifies the cosmos, the creation, with the Logos. So in Philo's philosophy, Yahweh is the creator, Sophia is the wisdom of the creation, and their son is the Logos, who Philo identifies with the created cosmos. In Philo's description of this, he points to the characteristics of Sophia becoming imparted to the Logos, to the sun. And so, reading the philosophy of Philo of Alexandria, it becomes actually quite difficult to distinguish between Sophia and the Logos. And this was a key factor in the disappearance of Sophia in the later tradition. The philosophy of Philo was picked up and was commentated upon by many of the church fathers. And in the thinking of some of the church fathers, Sophia and the Logos became identified because of this similarity in the description. So we find that Origen of Alexandria, one of the great Greek church fathers, describes Sophia as being identical with the Logos. Other theologians amongst the church fathers point to Sophia as being identical with the Holy Spirit. The main thrust, however, came with the identification of Sophia with the Logos. So I'd like to look into this in a little more detail. Very decisive in this was the great controversy in the early history of Christianity, which is known as the Arian controversy. Arius was bishop of Alexandria, and he developed the idea that the Logos is a created being. So in the thinking of Arius, Logos and Sophia are the same being. Crucial to an understanding of this are the words at the beginning of the Gospel of St. John. In the beginning was the Word. We could say, in the beginning was the Logos, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. This was in the beginning with God. All things were made through the Word, and nothing that was made without the Word. We could say, all things were made through the Logos, and nothing that was made without the Logos. This points to the fact that John was familiar with concepts of Greek philosophy, in particular with the concept of the Logos. In all probability, he received this idea through Philo of Alexandria. And if we take the statement of John that the Logos was in the beginning and that all things were made through the Logos, if we compare this statement with the statement of Sophia in the book of Proverbs, where she says that she was created at the beginning of the works of the Lord, then we can see that if one were to identify the Logos and Sophia one could come to the conclusion, as Arius did, that the Logos is a created being. This view that the Logos was a created being was fiercely opposed by Athanasius, another early Christian theologian of the 4th century, and this led to the great Arian controversy in which Arius was opposed by Athanasius. Athanasius stood for the conviction that the Logos is not a created being, but is of the same substance as the Creator, so that the Father and the Son are inwardly connected, that, in the words of Athanasius, the Father begets the Son, but does not create the Son, that the Son is of one and the same substance as the Father. And he opposed this idea to the teaching of Arius that the Son was created by the Father. As it happens, in this great controversy, which was fought out at the first ecumenical council called by the Emperor Constantine the Great in 325 AD, as it happens, the philosophy of Arius was condemned and that of Athanasius became the central teaching of Christianity. But in this process, we find that because Sophia became identified with the Logos, that she became pushed into the background, or in fact, more or less forgotten. So although early Christianity inherited the Old Testament, including the books of wisdom relating to divine Sophia, because of the identification of Sophia with the Logos, Sophia became lost from the history of Western Christianity. She did not become completely lost, as I shall go into, but receded into the background. So for our considerations here, we can see that in this Arian controversy, which shook and gripped the whole of early Christianity, that central to this was the identification of Sophia with the Logos. I'll just read a brief passage from the writings of Arius. The Son was created and established by the Father before the aeons. He is not eternal or uncreated like the Father, and also does not have the same manner of being as the Father. So this was the view of Arius. If we contrast this with the view of Athanasius, Athanasius, interestingly enough, agrees with the identification of the Logos and Sophia, but arrives at a different interpretation. In the writings of Athanasius, he says, "We have rebelled against the unreasonable and delusional conceptions of Arius. It is simply not right to call the Son a creature. We have also learned to read the passage in Proverbs correctly. It is written there, 'The Lord created me, the first of his works, long ago.' The meaning that is hidden here and the right interpretation has to be sought. This passage cannot simply be understood as if the meaning were openly revealed. If what is written here were to refer to an angel or to some other existing being, the expression, 'He created me,' could be used as it could with one of us creatures. If, however, it is God's Sophia, in whom all existing things have been created, who speaks thusly of herself, one can only think that she wants to say by the words, 'He created,' nothing other than 'He begot.' Wisdom does not speak of herself saying, 'I am a creature,' but only, 'The Lord created me, the first of his works, long ago.' The expression 'He created' does not mean that what is referred to as created is necessarily, or according to its substance, a creature." Here Athanasius tries to defend his view that the Logos is not a created being, by taking the identification of the Logos with Sophia and trying to reinterpret the statement of Sophia herself in Proverbs that she was created at the beginning of time. So we see how it is an extraordinary tragedy that this identification of the Logos and Sophia took place. Looking back over the course of time, we can begin to grasp something of the enormous magnitude of this tragedy, of this identification. It meant that the inspiration of Sophia became pushed back, became forgotten in the history of Western Christianity. The tragedy is that Sophia became lost from Christianity, from feeling for the divine feminine, so that the relationship to the divine feminine became lost in Christianity. And this means that the whole evolution of Christianity has been in the spirit of this one-sided, rational development, which has also produced modern science and technology, so that the feminine mode of thought, the thinking of the heart, became more and more excluded from Christian thinking. And this, I believe, has now to be corrected. One example of what a tragedy it was, this loss of Sophia from Christianity, is that Christianity has by and large ignored the world of nature. Nature, which for the Greeks was Mother Earth or Demeter, became forgotten. We find that actually the ancient mystery centers dedicated to the divine feminine became one by one closed down around the time of the arising of Christianity. So we see here actually an evolutionary development, an evolutionary tendency to exclude the divine feminine around the time of the coming of Christ 2,000 years ago. And now, I believe, is the time when this has to become redressed, this imbalance that arose at that time. So if we look at the great mystery center of Artemis in Ephesus, or at the mystery center of Demeter in Eleusis, or the mysteries connected with Isis in Egypt, all of these became closed down around the time of the advent of Christianity. The reason for this we find in Christianity itself, that with the coming of Christ, the divine masculine became placed in the foreground. By this, I'm referring to the teaching of Christ when he speaks of himself and the Father as being one. He uses the expression, "No one comes to the Father but by me." And he teaches the Our Father, the Lord's Prayer, as the central prayer of Christianity. If we look at this whole arising of Christianity, we see that Christ came into a patriarchal society, into the world of Israel, and that he chose male disciples. The whole thrust of the teaching of Christ was in the context of this patriarchal culture. If we try to imagine Christ having incarnated as a woman, then, of course, it would have been impossible to be able to give his message in the patriarchal society of Israel. So, in that context, it was only conceivable that Christ came as a male, into a male body. And the whole context of the founding of Christianity was therefore that of Christ pointing to the Divine Father. And I believe now that there is a fundamental transition taking place, which we'll come to in the course of these Sophia teachings, which points to a new revelation, a new unfolding in the context of Christianity that will now accommodate the divine feminine. In a certain respect, we can understand this whole development, this emphasis on the divine masculine that took place with the coming of Christ 2,000 years ago. This was all part of the development that we find prefigured in Greek philosophy with the transition from Plato to Aristotle. We saw that Plato directs us to the world of ideas, to the divine Sophia, and that Aristotle is really focusing upon the creative work of the Logos. Aristotelian philosophy triumphed, we could say, over Platonic philosophy. And in his way, Aristotle was preparing for the coming incarnation of the Logos as Christ, so that Aristotelian philosophy provided a certain bedrock, at least for the later development of Christianity. We need only think of St. Thomas Aquinas, who is looked upon as the greatest Christian theologian, who built his whole philosophy upon that of Aristotle. So here we see this whole stream of the Logos becoming emphasized at the expense of the stream of Sophia. The question arises, why did this development take place? We can say that it was all part of this drive for the development of the free, creative human being, that the overemphasis upon the Logos, upon the masculine side of existence, had to take place in order for humanity, at least humanity in the West, to develop creative faculties. Our whole Western civilization would be unthinkable without this one-sided development. But now this development has gone too far. It has reached a point of imbalance, and something new has to come in. So, looking again at the great image of Greek mythology, we can see that this mythological world of the gods that was a reality for human beings in antiquity gave way to this conception of the one incarnated divine being, the Logos, the Christ, who incarnated upon the earth for the transformation of the earth, for the redemption of the earth. And so this became the focus in Christianity, the activation of will and intelligence to participate in this work of redemption, but at the expense of the more feminine qualities of the heart. On the other hand, if we look at the actual teachings of Christ, we find that he himself embodied also these feminine qualities, and he was surrounded not just by male disciples, but by the holy women, his mother, the Virgin Mary, and other women such as Mary Magdalene and Martha. All of these figures are important for our understanding of what Christ was all about, of what his deeper message was. It was, in a deeper sense, really the balancing, the marriage of the masculine and the feminine. But the context, the setting of his teaching necessitated the bringing forth of the masculine side. And this is what then comes about in the unfolding of Christian theology, what we could call the repression or the pushing back of the Sophianic side of existence. Here and there, however, we find this Sophianic side does come through nevertheless. And in order to bring this out, I'd like to look at a couple of passages in the New Testament that point to this. There is a passage by St. Paul in his letter to the Ephesians, which refers to divine wisdom. St. Paul says, "To me, who am less than the least of all God's people, he has granted the privilege of proclaiming to the Gentiles the good news of the unfathomable riches of Christ, and of bringing to light how this hidden purpose was to be put into effect. It lay concealed for long ages with God, the Creator of the universe, in order that now, through the Church, the wisdom of God in its infinite variety might be made known to the rulers and authorities in the heavenly realms. This accords with his age-long purpose, which he accomplished in Christ Jesus, our Lord." This text proclaims wisdom in a personal manner as Sophia. It refers to the unfathomable mystery of divine wisdom kept secret by the Creator, but which is now, through Christ, to become revealed. So this is one reference which could be interpreted in the light of Sophia. However, the most important and most significant reference to Sophia is that by St. John in the book of Revelation, in chapter 12, where he brings this mighty, dramatic image. He speaks of the great sign appearing in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. This is a dramatic image of the divine Sophia as the wisdom of the cosmos, who embraces all the stars, all the planets, the sun, down to the moon, and who shines from the cosmos as the world soul. We find this idea taken up by the Neoplatonists, who spoke of the world soul, the soul of the cosmos. And this is a true designation for divine Sophia. So here and there we find that there were references within Christianity to Sophia, but these are few and far between, and generally speaking became lost from the main current of Christianity. On the other hand, outside of the development of Christianity, I've referred already to the Neoplatonists, there was a living conception of Sophia. And here and there, where in later tradition the ideas of Sophia broke through, we find it more or less in a mystical context that this took place. And we'll go into further detail about the mystical tradition of Divine Sophia later on. Thank you. It's quite clear with the coming of Christ that we have a major transition in the whole of human evolution. We'll go into the cosmological implications of this later on in these Sophia teachings. But for now, let's focus upon the fact that this whole transition was also part of the work of Divine Sophia, that it was, in a certain respect, allowed through a holding back on the part of Divine Sophia herself to allow the Divine Masculine, to allow the Logos to come into the foreground. That this really is the mystery of the coming of Christ. It is not only the coming of Christ as the incarnation of the Logos, but also the incarnation of Sophia as a parallel event, but an event that signified the holding back of Sophia in order to allow the Logos to come into the foreground. So if we look at the actual events taking place around the Christ, we find that Sophia is truly represented on the one hand in the figure of the Virgin Mary, on the other hand in the holy women such as Mary Magdalene and Martha, who were the companions of Jesus Christ. If we wish to grasp the deeper significance of this Sophianic element surrounding and accompanying the work of Christ, we can look at the special relationship that Jesus Christ had with the holy women. Primarily, then, we have the mother of Jesus Christ, the Virgin Mary, who was a truly extraordinary being, a being who embodied the qualities of divine wisdom, a being of extraordinary purity, a being whose heart was fully open, who could read the thoughts of all those around her through her opened heart, who became the life and soul of this community of disciples gathered together by Jesus Christ. The being of Mary was open on the one hand to the people around her in silent knowledge of what was taking place within them, and on the other hand was open to the cosmos and also open to the earth. We could say that the Virgin Mary really embodies the qualities that we human beings need to develop into the future. That is, a heartfelt awareness of our fellow human beings, a sense of connectedness with the whole cosmos, and a sense of unitedness with the whole earth. In this respect, the Virgin Mary was a forerunner, a model for future humanity. Looking now at others in the circle of holy women, we find that different attributes, different qualities of the Divine Feminine are represented by these women close to Jesus Christ. I'd like to focus briefly on Mary Magdalene and her sister Martha. These two were the sisters of Lazarus. Lazarus, who dwelt in a home, more like a castle, we could say, in Bethany, close to Jerusalem. Mary Magdalene and Martha were human beings who were in an intensely close relationship to Jesus Christ. There are great mysteries connected with this, and something of this mystery opens up if we consider this family, Lazarus, Mary Magdalene, and Martha, as a trio who related to different aspects of the being of Christ. Lazarus we could describe as the spiritual companion of Jesus Christ, one who died and was raised from the dead by Jesus Christ, who died into Christ through his deep and intense spiritual relationship to Christ, who was then called back to life in order to fulfill a great mission. So Lazarus we could look upon as the spiritual companion of the Christ, Mary Magdalene as the soul companion, this woman who was so closely related as a soul companion to Jesus Christ that she was the first human being to behold him at the time of the resurrection. In the Garden of the Holy Sepulchre on Easter Sunday morning, when she came into the garden, she beheld him, first of all thinking that he was the gardener, and then realizing that this was her master who had risen from the dead. Just in this scene, this appearance of the risen Christ to Mary Magdalene, we can begin to experience something of the deep and profound relationship between these two beings. Mary Magdalene as the companion on the level of the soul for Jesus Christ. There was indeed a deep and profound soul relationship between Jesus Christ and Mary Magdalene. Thirdly, if we look at Martha, we can conceive of Martha as one who chose to attend to the bodily needs of Jesus Christ and the community of the disciples. Martha was extremely active in helping the disciples, in caring for them, and making sure that the necessities of life were available to Jesus Christ and the disciples. And so we can look at this family of Lazarus and his two sisters as companions of Jesus Christ. Lazarus as the spiritual companion, Mary Magdalene as the soul companion, and Martha as the one who chose to care for the necessities of life on the bodily level for Jesus Christ and the disciples. Here again we can see aspects of the Divine Sophia shining through, on the one hand, with the Virgin Mary as a complete embodiment of the Divine Sophia on a spiritual level, with Mary Magdalene on a soul level, and with Martha on the bodily level. And I'll go into this in greater detail because it points to three aspects of the Divine Sophia to humanity. And this is a central element of the Sophia teachings, to grasp these three aspects of the Divine Sophia, which we can see represented in what I've just recounted in the Virgin Mary, in Mary Magdalene, and in Martha. So looking at the life of Jesus Christ, although he himself comes forward as the incarnated Logos and points to the Father through the holy women around him, he is bringing to expression the relationship of the Logos to Sophia, to the divine feminine. And this comes through implicitly in all of his teaching, in all of his deeds, that he is working together with the Divine Sophia, that there is an intimate interweaving taking place all the time between the Logos and the Sophia, between Christ and Sophia. Just to give one example of this, I'd like to refer to the first miracle described in the Gospel of St. John, the miracle of the changing of water into wine at the wedding at Cana. Jesus and his mother and a large number of the disciples who were at that time mainly friends and relatives of Jesus and Mary were all invited to the wedding at the little town of Cana, just northeast of Nazareth. They're invited there to the wedding of Nathanael of Cana with his bride-to-be. And as is described in the Gospel of St. John, Jesus had responsibility at this wedding for providing for the second course of wine which was to be served at the wedding. We can imagine this gathering in this little town, this wedding taking place according to the Jewish tradition, and afterwards there being a gathering for all those invited to the wedding, at which a meal was provided and at which wine was to be served. There it is described how, after the first course of wine, Mary reminds Jesus that he's responsible for the second course of wine to be served. Jesus then gives the command that six vessels of water are to be fetched, and he then blesses the water. He does this all in the presence of his mother, and in this reminding of Mary to Jesus that he's responsible for providing the wine, we can see something of the quality of Sophia through Mary addressing the Logos in Christ. And through this miracle that took place, we can see in the transformation of water to wine something of this interweaving. The water symbolizes the water of life, becoming transformed into wine through the power of divine love represented by the Logos. We could say that the Christ brought down the fire of divine love into the water of wisdom. That here we have a magical act, an interweaving between the Logos and Sophia. And all of those who drank of this wine, which was actually transformed water imbued with the spirit of divine love, all of those who drank of this were filled with the power of divine love and were united in a community in which they recognized Christ as the chosen one. So this was the first miracle in the Gospel of St. John, the miracle of the changing of water into wine at the wedding at Cana, which we could interpret in the following sense. The whole history of the people of Israel was one of being guided by divine Sophia through the kings, through the prophets, and that this we can liken to this stream of living water flowing down through the ages. The incarnation of the Logos as the power of divine love comes into this stream of wisdom and transforms it into wine. This is a symbolic interpretation of this miracle, that here we have the interweaving of wisdom, Sophia, and the Logos, the Christ. This is just one example drawn from the Gospels, which reveals an interweaving between divine Sophia as the wisdom of creation and the Logos as the Word, as the power of divine love. And the whole of the composition of the life of Jesus Christ really brings to expression this interweaving of divine love and divine wisdom. So, although Sophia or the divine feminine became pushed into the background. Nevertheless, this was part of the plan of evolution, that the element of divine love born by the Logos should come into the foreground and should live as the inspiring power for Western humanity down through the ages, down until the present time. Now, however, we are entering a new age in which the impulse of divine Sophia is to flow in, having been held back over the last 2,000 years. And therefore, this is the challenge of our time, to allow now divine Sophia into our lives, to allow divine wisdom to begin to speak, to allow this impulse of the wisdom of the world, which has been held back for so long, to now become the inspiring, guiding voice in human hearts from now on into the future. So before we continue to look at the further unfolding of the Sophia tradition in the post-Christian period of time as a small but significant stream of spiritual evolution, let's just consider briefly what we've looked at up until now. We've looked at the work of Divine Sophia as a power of inspiration in the whole of antiquity, inspiring different religions, different spiritual traditions, as the ageless wisdom, the perennial wisdom from which the different traditions have lived. Sophia has revealed herself in different aspects in the different religions of antiquity. And in the Christian religion, with the founding of Christianity, held herself back in order to allow the voice of the Logos to sound in full strength through the mystery of the incarnation of the Logos in Christ. So we can see that the work of the Sophia in antiquity was largely to prepare the way for this great event of the incarnation of Christ. As St. Augustine said, in looking to Plato, here we have an example of a Christian in pre-Christian times, one who was preparing the way for this event of the incarnation of the Logos. And even in the case of Buddhism, I believe we can see a preparation for this event. Buddha, who brought the teaching of compassion, the teaching of the living out of compassion, and Christ as the one who was the embodiment of the power of love, of which Buddha was speaking. So, in the sense of an overall comprehensive plan of evolution, we can look upon the Divine Sophia as preparing the way in different parts of the earth with different groups of human beings to give different themes that would then all come together to be focused in the central event of the incarnation of Christ, and how then at this time Sophia was also present, accompanying the Christ through the Virgin Mary, through the holy women around the Christ, but that these held back their impulse, really in a gesture of silent expectation, a gesture of allowing the Logos to present himself with full strength as the being upon whom humanity should now focus. And this has been the case now for 2,000 years, and now it is the time or the turn of Divine Sophia to begin to speak again. This is the significance of the New Age into which we have entered in the 20th century and in the later course of the Sophia teachings. I'll go into this into greater detail, particularly when we consider the cosmological aspects of the Sophia teachings. It emerges that with the 20th century, we have the beginning of the inpouring of the Divine Feminine as a world-transforming power for the future, as a redressing of the imbalance that has been created over the last 2,000 years, and as the possibility for the bringing into balance of the Divine Masculine and the Divine Feminine within each human being. So this, I see, is the great promise of our time and the great work of the Divine Sophia in bringing humanity now a further step forward. So we'll go into this in the next session of the Sophia teachings.